Well, first of all, we want to welcome our new member, Representative Ann New. Welcome. I'm happy to have you. I wonder if, I don't know if Representative Hertas has had a chance to look at the minutes, but I wonder if you would move the minutes, Representative Hertas, from the meeting of February 20th.
I think, Madam Chair, we have to have a quorum before we do that.
We do have a quorum.
Oh, we do. All right. Well, thank you. I will move the minutes from the last meeting.
Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Let me try that again. Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the minutes of February 20th are approved. Thank you. And we're changing up our order just a little bit today, so we're going to take up House File 745 first. And we do have Representative Howe standing in for Representative Wills. So we appreciate that very much. So I'm going to move the House File 745, members, and that is going to be re-referred to Transportation Finance. Is that right?
Yes.
Transportation Finance. Okay. So welcome, Representative Howe, and please describe your bill for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a bill that was authored by Representative Wills, and I'm honored to be able to present it to you today. And actually what this bill does is it takes the bridge on County State 8 Highway 46 and names it the Corporal Benjamin S. Kopp Bridge. Corporal Benjamin Kopp was from Rosemont, Minnesota. He died July 18, 2009 at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. Ben had a deep love of country, was proud to serve and defend the freedoms of our beautiful America. Ben was a true friend to all and all who knew him. He was a shining example of patriotism, selflessness, and will be sorely missed. Ben graduated from Rosemont High School in 2006. He left for Fort Benning 1 month later. He was assigned to Company C, 3rd Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment, where he served as a rifleman. And I got a soft spot for Ranger folks because my son was trained as a Ranger. He distinguished himself by numerous awards. He was awarded the Bronze Star with Valor, the Meritorious Service Medal, and the Purple Heart. He was hit with an IED, and that's where he served. That's how he died. But this would honor him and his family by naming that bridge in his honor. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's the gist of the bill.
And Representative Howe, I see we have an amendment, the author's amendment, the A1.
Yes, ma'am. The author's amendment, what that does is there's a couple of misspellings in the drafting of the bill, Dakota and Mark, and that would get into the bill and in the shape it should be, or
right.
I see there's some tension up there.
But we'll call on Mr. Burris. Apparently there's some other explanation that we'd like to hear. So, Mr. Burris?
Madam Chair, members, it adds a couple of words to reflect the standard conventions in referring to roads in statute.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Representative Howe?
Madam Chair, I did not know we have testifiers for this bill.
Sure.
So,
and we'll be happy to hear them. Let's first just get the amendment passed. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So now for your testifiers, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you. I don't know who wishes to go first, but if you'd like to, please state your name for the record and proceed with your comments.
I can go first.
All right.
Who's going to go first at 10 o'clock tonight? So
that's right. I recognize that.
Right,
sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee members. My name is John Berood, and I am Benjamin Kopp's maternal grandfather. I wrote a few notes down here in support of this bill, and will state a few of the reasons why I think this should be passed and the bridge should be named after him. So if you don't mind, I'm going to read this for just
testimony.
A couple minutes. One of the things that is in support of this is Oliver North wrote a book called Special Operations a number of years ago. And my grandson, Benjamin Kopp, is highlighted in a chapter of this book. Is written in his honor, and it describes some things about him. If anybody would care to look at it while I'm talking, if you look quick, so I get to talk quick. And then also there is a meritorious award here, the Bronze Star Certificate, that details what happened to him and why this Bronze Star was given to him, posthumously.
Perhaps the page would like to pass those around.
Madam Chair, if we could read that.
Very good. Representative Howe.
Can't do it without glasses. Exceptionally meritorious achievement as a machine gun team leader for Joint Task Force in support of Operation Enduring Freedom. On this date, Corporal Kopp led a machine gun team against numerous heavily armed enemy combatants, bringing heavy fire from close range. Corporal Kopp placed accurate suppressive fires on multiple locations, allowing the recovery of a reconnaissance team that had been decisively engaged and unable to maneuver. His actions contributed to the destruction of 12 enemy fighters. Corporal Kopp's ultimate sacrifice undoubtedly saved the lives of multiple Rangers. Through his distinctive accomplishments, Corporal Kopp reflected great credit upon himself, this command, and the United States Army. Period, 10 July 2009, given under my hand in the city of Washington, Deputy Major General Joseph L. Vogel and the Secretary of the Army. Oh, there you go, native of St. Paul.
Very good. And Mr. Bird, would it be all right if we'd pass that around to the
members?
Please
do, yes, okay. Yes.
Great, thank
I'll
you.
I'll make a comment about General Votel. He's a St. Paul resident, still has a residence here. 2 years ago, he was appointed as the Special Operations Four-Star General, appointed by President Obama. And recently, he's been assigned as the lead general in all of the Middle East fighting. So he was my daughter's escort at Benjamin's funeral. So enough about General Tello. Go on to read here. I'm honored to be here to give this presentation regarding my grandson and the possibility of having a bridge named in his honor. Who is Benjamin Kopp and why should he be honored in this manner? He was an Army Ranger in Special Operations. He grew up in Rosemount, graduated in 2006, and started his military career immediately after high school in 2006. Once he became a Ranger, he was deployed three times, twice in Iraq and once in Afghanistan. During the Afghanistan deployment, he was wounded while trying to save his fellow Rangers during an attack by the Taliban. It was in this battle on July 10th that he was wounded and died 9 days later. Even though many soldiers are killed during actions and deployments, what makes one soldier stand out more than others? I believe Ben was one of those soldiers who stood out more than others. His actions were a little bit different. He was assigned to the U.S. Army Special Operations Unit. Everything he did was secret. He couldn't tell his mother, couldn't tell me, couldn't tell anybody what they were doing. They are assigned secretive missions and are under imminent danger 100% of the time. Their assignments are to seek and destroy targets critical to the safety of soldiers and citizens of the country in which they are deployed. They also attempt to destroy targets that would cause danger or death to American soldiers located in the regions of their assignments. While on this mission, Benjamin was shot in the leg. He did die 8 days later after he was shot. And when I received a call from my daughter that Ben had been shot, you know, it's a shocking thing. You don't know what's going to happen. But the interesting thing was, how was he honored? You know, he just wasn't another soldier that died in action. At his funeral at Rosemount High School, Senator Amy Klobuchar attended his funeral. Senator Al Franken attended his funeral. Governor Pawlenty with his wife attended his funeral. And Governor Pawlenty ordered that the flags throughout the state on that date be flown at half-mast. Governor Plenty was very friendly. He was an awful nice man. He greeted me, greeted my daughter. And that was just one way that he was recognized. You wonder why, you know, two U.S. senators and the governor would attend a funeral. During his funeral at Arlington, it was the first time in 2 years at his funeral that the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Army attended a soldier's funeral. And Al Franken and Amy Klobuchar were there. I had passed out a book here, Oliver North had written, called American Heroes, and he did devote a chapter to my grandson. Ben was an organ donor, and after he died, his organs were donated to a number of people, including his heart. There was over 60 people that received bones, tissue, and organs from Ben. His heart went to a woman in Illinois because of his donations. What had happened was that three of the morning television national news programs had invited my daughter and the woman who received his heart to appear in their shows and talk about this. In 2011, the Rose Bowl Parade has every year they have an organ donation float. 2011, the float had Benjamin's face done in flowers, and my son, who was an organ donor in 1982 when he died, his face was also on that float. In 2016, a highly decorated U.S. Army Ranger was being interviewed on national television, and this gentleman was credited with over 160 kills. And he was asked by the national news person doing the interview, "Do you have any regrets?" And he said, "I only have one, that I couldn't save Corporal Kopp." If you saw Benjamin Kopp today, or if he was here, and you wanted to thank him for what he has done, he would only say, "I was doing my job." He is a very humble man. He gave up his life to save his soldier buddies. He saved countless citizens by his organ donations. And to honor his name and accomplishments at such a young age, and naming a bridge in his honor would be a reminder to all those who crossed that bridge that he gave his life for his country, his fellow Rangers, and the citizens of this country. Finally, I'm going to quote a passage. It was on his obituary notice at the funeral homes. It was a picture of Ben and with the words from a Bible passage, John 13, and it says, quote unquote, "Greater love hath no man than a man lay down his life for his friends." Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Bill Lund.
Welcome.
Hi, how are you? It's nice to be here. I've been asked by Ben's mom, Jill Stevenson, to be here on her behalf. She lives in Florida now. For the last 2.5 years, I've been working on a book about Ben. The book is done. It's being printed right now. It's called Heart of a Ranger. So I know a lot about Ben's history and his service. On July 10th, 2009, Ben and a group of Rangers, about 65 Rangers, were in Helmand Province. They were on a mission to nab a high-ranking member of the Taliban. The mission was complicated because they were expected to bring this guy back alive. A lot of times Rangers just go in and kill their targets. In this case, they were trying to bring this person back alive. Unfortunately, the Taliban may have known they were coming that day because three of four squads came under heavy fire. In fact, one of the squads was a group of recon Rangers and some snipers, and they were in such a bad state that they were laying body on body on body in a 3-foot hole just trying to escape fire. They did that for more than an hour, begging for help over the radio. Ben's squad was the only squad that was not decisively engaged, so they came running to their rescue. Ben was part of a machine gun team. He set up this machine gun along with some other Rangers who set up their weapons, and they opened up with cover fire. Those snipers and recon guys then jumped up and sprinted as fast as they could under fire in order to escape, and incredibly, none of them were even injured in doing that. One of them, who John mentioned, is a sniper named Nick Irving, and Nick has said that if it weren't for Ben and that team coming to rescue them, all six of them would be dead today. In fact, Nick told me that he was contemplating suicide himself because he didn't want to give the Taliban the satisfaction of killing him. Unfortunately, moments later, they were exiting that area, and they were on their way to a safe house, a compound, and they came under attack again. They were ambushed again. And this time, their platoon leader was hit in the back, and Ben was hit in the lower thigh. The bullet went all the way through his leg and split his popliteal artery, so he's bleeding profusely. Some of the other Rangers there tried to save him and dragged him about 800 meters under fire through a ditch back to the safe house. But a few days later, Ben lay at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., and doctors told his mom that he was brain dead. They consulted his blue book, and in that blue book it said, do you want to be an organ donor? And Ben had checked yes. And then the question was asked, if so, which organs do you wish to donate? And Ben had written in his own hand, any that are needed. Within 24 hours, a teenager in the Washington, D.C. area had one of Ben's kidneys. A young man had another kidney. About a 60-year-old man had his liver. A woman in Pennsylvania had his pancreas. And his heart was on a jet flying for Chicago. Eventually, a 57-year-old woman from the Chicago area got his heart, and she's alive today. Jill, myself, John, I believe you too, we've all met her. We've all felt Ben's heart beating in this woman's chest, which is really an incredible legacy for Ben. What has been written about Ben is that in his very last act in life, he saved six of his fellow Army Rangers, and his first act in death, he saved about six people, if not more, through other forms of organ donation. He knew the risks, too. I've interviewed his friends from Rosemont, Josh Maldonado and Richard Rivera, and the last time Ben was home visiting, he said, they confronted him. They said, change your job. Get out of the Rangers. Do something else. Become a supply officer. You're going to die. It's too dangerous. And Ben said, I'm a patriot. I don't care. I will die for my country. Across his chest, he had a tattoo that in Greek said, freedom isn't free. So Ben was willing, he knew the risks and was willing to lay down his life for his country, which he eventually did. Jill hangs on to his pickup truck. Ben has, I don't know, a 2006 Chevy Silverado. It's got a big picture of Ben across it. And every summer there's a Ben Cop Memorial motorcycle ride out of Apple Valley. And I said to her the other day, wouldn't that be something else to be driving that truck with about 100 motorcycles behind us and drive it right over the Ben Cop Memorial Bridge? We think that would be pretty special. So thank you very much.
Wonderful story, and thanks for sharing with us. I mean, it's an amazing man. So, are there questions? Any folks from the committee or? Okay, all right. Well, we appreciate you bringing this bill, and we appreciate Representative Wills also his involvement in this. So, seeing no other questions or comments regarding the bill, we'll move to the vote, and I will renew the motion that House File 745, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay. The bill is passed. Thank you very much. And we are next going to take up the Baker bill. Is Representative Baker. Okay. Okay. While we're waiting, we have a small correction to the minutes from today. So it would be on page 2, fourth line from the bottom. And the change would be Representative Kosnick renewed the motion that House File 1160 be laid over instead of House File 418. So all those in favor of the amended minutes, please signify by saying aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. So we are waiting for Representative Baker. And so we'll take up, if Representative Barr is ready with your first bill, Representative, why don't we take that up now? House File 1117.
The obligatory first retreat.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. I just want to acknowledge here, Representative Barr is doing the traditional bringing treats at his first presentation, so I know we have a number of few other freshmen on the committee, and treats are always very welcome, but especially on your first turn or first bill that you present. So just a note for future reference.
Thank you for the heads up there. Appreciate that. All right, Representative Barr, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chairman, I'd like to move that House File 1117 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Very good. And Representative Barr, please present your bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 1117 is a bill that would change the zoning laws in this, in a portion of the city of Oak Grove from,
where are they at now? From commercial to the residential.
Residential, yeah.
Diversified rural.
From diversified residential to,
we're changing it to.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
We're both a little flustered here, first time out of the box.
Okay.
I'm sorry. So we're changing it from high-density housing to rural residential. That's what we're changing it to, rural residential, which would maintain the city of Oak Grove into a 2.5-acre lot size for the entire city. This is where it has been for decades, 2.5 as a minimum. And through the 2040 plan, the Thrive 2040 plan, this 1,100 acres of the city of Oak Grove was changed into to high-density housing, and this bill will change this back. And for details, I'd like to have a testifier.
Sure. Yes, so you have your testifier. Representative, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, sir?
And, thank you, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. and committee members.
Please proceed with your testimony.
I appreciate the opportunity to come down here today. I am the mayor for the city of Oak Grove, Minnesota. I have a long history of taking and learning about what happens in my city. I've been active in my community's government for over 25 years. I've held every volunteer position, every elected position, and I even volunteered to be the city administrator before I became mayor. So I know our city, and I know that our leadership as an elected official is to guide the city, to make sure that the plans and the finances and everything is on a daily basis is operating fine. But then when it comes to long-term planning, our leadership is important in making those decisions. But I'm going to tell you here today that I feel like my election certificate doesn't mean a thing. Everyone in this committee has an election certificate, and that you hope that your voice makes a difference. I'm asking if what I'm going to say today makes a difference, because there's an unelected body called the Metropolitan Council. They're an appointed group that decides they know what's best for all of our communities in the 9-county metro area. I'm going to tell you that after the 2010 comprehensive plan overview, the 2020 plan overview that I was actively a member of, I helped write most of our ordinances. In 2030, I was the chair for the comprehensive plan rewrite for my city. I think I have a little bit of credibility to understand where we've come from, where we are today, and where reasonable, common sense development, growth, and planning should be for my community. It's frustrating when I and the rest of our council, all five of us on our council, believe the same thing, that the overreaching high-density area in 1,100 acres of my city by the Met Council, 3 homes per acre, doesn't fit any development plans that we've had since 1993 when we became a city. Over those 25 years, we've always been able to subdivide large properties, whether it be 20 acres, 200 acres, and we as a city, we as the elected officials, set a minimum of 2.5 acres for those minimum lot sizes as an average overall density. What the Met Council's demand was back in 2008 when I was on the city council was basically, you can continue to do the 2.5-acre development, but we're going to take and force you to take 1,100 acres of your city and put 3 homes per acre in the middle of nowhere. There's no development growth from East Bethel. Oak Grove is on the northern Anoka County border. We're just north of Andover, west of East Bethel, east of Nowthen, and south of St. Francis. So we're in a northern Anoka County area. What I'm asking for you today, because I cannot get anybody to hear these requests at the Met Council because their hands are tied. And the next bill that you're going to hear about is one of the things that they keep saying to us as elected officials, what I have to say here today doesn't mean anything. You have that ability. You have that ability to not only look at reasonable planning long term for the city of Oak Grove and other cities, but you have a chance to help our residents have the same land use ability as the rest of my community. In this area, if I had a homeowner with 10 acres, 20 acres that wanted to give Susie, their daughter, 5 acres of it as a wedding present, they couldn't do it. Because this is dedicated now, right now in the comp plan, our comp plan mandated 3 homes per acre. You cannot do that. So what we're saying is unreasonable, overreaching authority by the Met Council has got to stop. And I'm going to stand up for those property right owners, those people in 1,100 acres and throughout all of Oak Grove and in Minnesota. What's happening to my city is unacceptable. And I'm going to stand up because the landowners' rights, the people that are living there, should have the same ability as the rest of my community. Now, I concede that they have the ability, Met Council does, to plan for the years 2017 to 2040. That's within the statute. But what they're doing to us is even beyond that. They're saying there's no engineering, there's no planning, there's no financing, all the way up to the year 2040. But they're saying maybe in 2060, 2010, maybe there might be a need someday for high densities encroachment onto the city of Oak Grove. Now, finishing this up, it may be different if Andover had high density on our border, if East Bethel had high density on our border, if Nowthen or St. Francis was encroaching into the growth, we could see in the next 20 years it would make sense to look and plan for that. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about what our community is a bedroom community where I like to tell people where the unicorns run free. There's a pot of gold in everybody's backyard. People like our bedroom community. That's what it is. It's 2.5 acre large lot development. We've been doing it for the last 25 years, and I'm asking for your help to remove and to give me a voice again through the legislature. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Mayor, just refresh us again the size of your city miles, and then also what kind of growth population-wise have you had? Since
minimal growth,
2000.
Obviously, no, less than that.
No, since 2000.
Oh, well, less than 1,000 people since 2000. I can get you that those numbers for all of the surrounding communities. My city is 36 square miles, so it's made up of mostly subdivisions of 2.5 acres. There's a lake, 2 golf courses. I mean, it's a rural environment where 3 homes per acre, that mandate on my city and my residents, is unacceptable.
All right. Do we have any folks that wish to question, or were there any questions? Okay. No? Okay. So we have a couple of other testifiers. Please come forward. Okay. I do have a question. From the members. So Representative Hertas, do you want to take care of that?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Mayor. Thank you for your testimony. I see that the Metropolitan Land Planning Act provides for different tools with regard to preparing the comprehensive plan in their increments, in this case Thrive 2040. And it says basically that the council preparation of the Metropolitan Development Guide, known as Thrive 2040, is developed with public hearings, and that the regional plans for wastewater collection and treatment, transportation, et cetera, are done so. So kind of what I'm hearing you say is you're really out on the fringe of this guide plan in terms of your geographic location, and your community has a vision that it wants to implement. And it sounds to me as though it's, even though there were perhaps public hearings, it doesn't sound like your voice was heard very well, because it sounds like the guide plan is quite different than your community's vision of itself. Is that a correct interpretation of what you're trying to say?
Madam Chair.
Mayor Grant.
Madam Chair, Representative, Committee Member. I'm a little nervous. I'm on the other side, so it's unique for me to be here testifying here. This is my first time, so I appreciate the opportunity. Representative, we've had this vision for our community since I got involved back in the early 90s. It's been that way. We were forced upon that 1,100 acres, and we had always been able to modify our comprehensive plan to any area across our city to one home per 2.5 acre. Wherever we were at, we went from diversified rural, which is one home in 10, to one home in 2.5, rural residential. That vision has always been in place. All five of us on council have always wanted and believed that our city should stay at one home per 2.5 acre. But that demand, and we followed the process. I wrote letters in the packet of information that you have with you. I wrote letters. We followed the process to take it to a judge, and the judge said, we can't even look at this because that one three-letter word, N-O-T, prevents us from looking at things like this, the reasonableness clause. So to answer your question clearly, Oak Grove does not and is vehemently against any high density in our community. I'm not asking for money. I'm not asking for Met Council's input in this case. All we want to be is what the rest of the residents have in our community, is one home per 2.5 acre across my city. Does that answer your question, sir?
So, good.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, and let's hear from then the Met Council, Mr. Shetnin. Good afternoon. You going first then, Mr. Shetnin?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Judd Shetnin with the Met Council, Government Affairs Director. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. And with me today, I have Lisa Barajas, who's our local planning manager for the Metropolitan Council. And we'd like to provide the committee with some additional detail related to this bill and some history that goes back into the decisions that were made and some of the decisions that were made by the city that have the council in the position of having to oppose this bill. And so Ms. Barajas will be able to go into that detail, and then we'll be able to stand for any questions you have related to that. And so if we can do that, I'm going to turn it over to Lisa.
Great. Please give us your name for the record and do proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lisa Barajas. I'm a manager of local planning assistance at the Metropolitan Council. And I just wanted to provide a little bit of history, as Judd had noted. First, that this bill would propose to designate that portion of the community in the southeastern portion of Oak Grove as rural residential. Its current designation is diversified rural. That retains and directs or asks communities to keep very low density development. That means density of no greater than one unit per 10 acres. This area is also designated by the council as a long-term wastewater service area. And by long-term, we mean post-2040, which is what Mayor Korn had noted earlier. So in the interim, up until wastewater services would be extended, we asked that communities retain a low-density development pattern that would not preclude future urban development should it be needed. I also wanted to note that this designation was made through a lot of discussion with the city in the last under our last administration at the council and under a city council at Oak Grove. A proposal was made by the City Council to compromise with the Metropolitan Council. Previous to that compromise, the City of Oak Grove had been designated as diversified rural for a couple of decades, asked to be retain very low-density development. Mayor Korn referenced a couple of amendments that had occurred, modifications that they had made to their plan that the council did sign off on, but not without warning that this would be a pattern that we found unsustainable and contrary to the Metropolitan Council's statutory obligations to manage the orderly and economical development of the region. The council found that 2 and 2.5 acre lots were contrary to that core mandatory, that core statute that directs the council's work. That's across the entire seven county metro. Under the previous Metropolitan Council administration, the council came to a compromise with the city. The city had proposed in a letter signed by 4 out of 5 of their city council members that in exchange for retaining that 1,100 acres in the southeast corner of their community as diversified rural, that they would ask that the remainder of their community be designated as rural residential. The council, Metropolitan Council, agreed to that compromise, and that compromise was then reflected in the city's 2030 comprehensive plan. That was adopted by the community, I believe, in 2009 or 2010. The Metropolitan Council subsequently updated its system plan to reflect that compromise in the city's comprehensive plan and then proceeded to make investments just to the east in East Bethel to build a regional wastewater system that would be sized at some point in the future to support future urban development in Oak Grove, with the understanding that that long-term service area would be a portion of that. So after giving you a little bit of that history, I just wanted to make some other points regarding this, regarding the proposed bill, in that and why we oppose this bill at the council. A number of different bodies have made decisions regarding planning in this particular area in Oak Grove over the last several decades that have led to that current designation of diversified rural that's and long-term wastewater service that's in Oak Grove today. That includes not just the Metropolitan Council, but also previous administrations at the council, previous city council members in the city of Oak Grove, which not only proposed that compromise in their letter, but also adopted their comprehensive plan reflecting as much. In addition, this very issue was heard before an administrative law judge who heard the entire case, made a recommendation related to a bill that is also on our agenda today, but also found that the city or that the Metropolitan Council did not act arbitrarily or capriciously in this designation in the process. This proposed bill would also disregard that decision-making role in the authorities, both of those previous administrations, the Oak Grove City Council, the regional planning body, and the courts, and the number of studies and the reasoning and rationale behind those studies that led to this ultimate designation. Finally, this pathway disregards any potential impacts of the proposed land designation change on the region, on surrounding communities, on other agencies, and on the environment. The proposed designation change would undermine the council's regional planning authorities and infrastructure investments that were made to serve Oak Grove in the future. The wastewater ratepayers would have to absorb that cost if Oak Grove does not retain that land, and those investments were only made after the city had agreed to do that work. Thank you.
Ms. Barras, how much is the investment that's been made then in the, is it wastewater treatment, did you say?
Yeah. Madam Chair, the facility, interceptor pipe has been built in size to serve Oak Grove in the future, and I believe it was about $3.5 million. I'm trying to recall off the top of my head. I may not quite have the number right.
But. All right, great. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair and members, I think the point is that after this agreement was put in place amongst all parties, then that investment was made. And now if we want to make a change from that, that investment that was made will sit there and not serve the purpose that it was done. And so what happens is the rest of the region who pays for this will end up paying for pipe, basically, that will sit there that was determined to be necessary based off an agreement that was put in place, And now this is changing that agreement, and it'll be to everybody else's responsibility to pay for it.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having served on a city council, I can tell you when I first got on, a lot of people wanted no development. But unfortunately, again, the previous city councils had made agreements with Met Council for the infrastructure, and you can't go back once you develop the infrastructure. And I guess that's always been my understanding. I mean, and I guess the question would be for either the representative or the previous testifier, are any of the people that were on the council at the time the agreement drawn up, are they still on the council?
Looks like Representative Barr has an answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Mason, East Bethel is kind of the home base for the sewer, the water tower, and everything else. And the first election after this was approved by the East Bethel City Council, everybody that was up for election was voted off. All of them, the mayor and both city council members that were up for election that year.
All right, any follow-up? Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mayor.
If I may add to that.
Please.
Some of the statements that are made here are incorrect in the fact that every year a city has to approve a comprehensive plan that you have to work together in a city to send it off to Met Council. They have the authority to say, no, we can do what you want. We were strong-armed into that decision. If the rest of our city was to have any subdivisions, we didn't have a choice. We wanted 2.5 acres forever. We've been allowed 14 different times over the last 20 years to have a subdivision be approved through the Met Council in modifying our comp plan. So this isn't something new. This isn't something that we've arbitrarily picked out of our planning development. We've always known that we were going to divide and allow landowners to divide down to the minimum of 2.5 acres. We are asking the committee to look at what we're going through here. It's not $3 million for the East Bethel system. It's $18 million that Met Council reimbursed the city $9 million for this failed system. In that packet of information that you have is a letter from the city administrator of East Bethel outlining the outrageous costs just for their citizens to hook up. To get that pipe from where it is currently, even to our border, is not planned for. Matter of fact, the system was originally installed, and by Natalie Steffen's own words, East Bethel's connection fees would pay for that at that time in 2007. So she was the Met Council rep to our area during that time. In the letter that I provided is the city administrator of East Bethel's outlining the outrageous costs to hook up to this system. And now that the taxpayers of Minnesota have so graciously paid East Bethel $9 million to their bond, now we're all on the hook for this. It wasn't, the pipes were sized, but it has nothing to do. Oak Grove never wanted it, and we were told if you don't sign your next comp plan, which was the 2030 comp plan, you won't be dividing any of your property. So we looked at it in this fashion. We looked at it as a stepping stone. If the projections actually paid off, where the growth potential that supposedly was magically going to happen in 2007 and 8 would happen, then you know what? Then it kind of made sense. And I'm here to tell you I'm reasonable when it comes to a higher density if that means that area would make sense. But when even the Met Council is not planning for anything between now and 2040, and they're telling us we need to tell those residents you don't have the right to subdivide or minimize your lot sizes for a family member or for a farmer that wants to retire and divide that, Minimizing that property is something that we've been allowed to do for 25 years. And it doesn't deviate from our current path. So right. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, Representative Barr, Regina, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure who to direct the question to because some new numbers were just thrown out, but I just wondered, I heard $3 million, now I'm hearing $18 million and $9 million, so maybe a little naively I wondered if the community could buy back the pipe, if you will, at $3 million, but if it was $9 million or $18 million, I'm not sure that would be feasible.
Yeah.
Mayor Coran?
Madam Chair and committee member, we didn't want anything to do with the East Bethel system. We couldn't vote on it. I was at all of those city council meetings telling them that this is a bad decision for East Bethel, and it's a really bad decision if you're talking about having Oak Grove continue on with that pipe into an area. Because from East Bethel, to push a pipe through already developed land, there's very minimal connections that can happen from where it is now to our border. Matter of fact, East Bethel canceled phase 2, 3, and 4, which would cause the expansion of their own system. Do you know that the East Bethel system is only operating at a 5% flow rate of what they're already in phase 1? So even if you lay out, forget Oak Grove, where the pipe is in East Bethel is operating at 5% of its efficiency. That has nothing to do with Oak Grove. It has to do with poor planning and poor decision-making at that time within East Bethel and the Met Council to allow this system to happen where the residents of Minnesota are paying the price for this boondoggle.
All right, another question. We're going to try to wrap this up in about 5 minutes. So Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is for Mr. Shetnam. Thank you. Mr. Shetnam, we have some drawings and maps, but we don't have anything to understand the system plan. I've got just a couple of questions about this. So is it my understanding that this new plant or new facility is established in East Bethel?
Madam Chair, Hertas, yes, that's correct. And it was put into place after an agreement was made amongst all of the parties to have that facility built.
Okay.
And the Oak Grove City Council was in agreement to that plan as well.
Madam Chair.
Follow-up?
So does this system plan... I'm presuming that it's moving to the west and north. Does this long-term vision of this system plan, does the East Bethel plant contemplate serving Nowthen and St. Francis in all of East Bethel, which looks like it's part of it, looks like the westernmost part of East Bethel is out. Can you tell me about what the long-term plan is for the capacity of this system?
Madam Chair, of Hertas, I'm going to let Ms. Barajas answer that question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Barajas?
Madam Chair, Senator, Representative Hertas, I'm not our wastewater engineer who knows more of the details on the long-term capacity of this, but I can tell you for a long-term service area, this plant would not serve the city of St. Francis, would not serve Bethel, would not serve Nowthen. Those were a couple of the communities you named. The long-term service area for this plant, as it's in our current plans, serves portions of East Bethel and the portion designated in Oak Grove.
Representative Hertas, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I'm looking at this plan, and I think I interpret the city lines correctly, it looks like close, not exactly the same, but close to amount of land area is marked white in East Bethel, which probably is outside of the service area at present. Is it possible to exchange Oak Grove's planned capacity for the East Bethel plant to serve all of East Bethel? Am I looking at this map correctly?
Ms. Barajas?
Madam Chair, Representative Hertaus, I don't have the map in front of me, so I'm not entirely sure. Thank you. On the white portion there. I see that. Representative Hertaus, you know, that would have to be a policy decision. My understanding in the development of the service area for the East Bethel portion of this, that was designated by East Bethel based on their landscape and their ability to support growth, in addition to where they thought growth would be most likely to occur within their community within the planning horizon, so through 2030. East Bethel is, like many communities in this part of Anoka County, has quite a few wetlands that cover the landscape, so there was a reason that the service area doesn't go much beyond what you see today on that map. I couldn't speak to whether or not that's an ability or an option that would have to be a policymaker decision, and it would have to be something that we would see East Bethel propose to expand beyond their service area. As our current forecast for East Bethel show, there isn't a need to expand beyond that. East Bethel is retaining very low-density development outside of their service area, and they are, like all communities in the metro, undergoing their long-range visioning and comprehensive planning process right now, where some of those boundaries may change, and we would review those at that time.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hertaus?
So the purple area inside Oak Grove, is that the extent of the planned service area, or are there different phases that the capacity of East Bethel plant contemplates serving all of Oak Grove or just that southeast corner?
Ms. Barajas?
Madam Chair, Representative Hertaus, it's just that purple corner in the southeastern part of the community that is planned for long-term wastewater service in Oak Grove. The compromise that I had referenced earlier designates the balance or that gray portion of the community as rural residential.
Okay. And one last question, Madam Chair.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I were to look at this map and not seeing the whole system area, do you have any idea what this small southeast corner of Oak Grove, what that represents as a percent of the total capacity when at 100% East Bethel would serve?
Ms. Barajas.
Madam Chair, Representative Hertaus, without looking at the numbers in front of me, it would be really hard to show that as a percentage, especially in capacity. What we're seeing in front of us is land area, which doesn't reflect the development that might occur on there. Residential, commercial, industrial development all have different flow rates, and depending on the density, may require or result in more flow or higher flow than other different types of development. So it really is dependent on the type of development that would occur. My understanding of the East Bethel portion, that's that light purple in the southwest corner, is that at this point in time that's being planned for post-2030 or post-2040 development. And so they are retaining that as low-density development at this time, very low-density rural, so that they at which point in the future that they have need for that land that they would extend into that area.
We're going to move on to Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is, I believe, a question for the mayor. I'm concerned about, we kind of just briefly touched on the decision by the administrative law judge. If you could walk us through the conclusions on the part that were made to that body.
Mm-hmm.
There's Mayor Fran?
Oh, I'm sorry. Madam Chair and committee members, there's a process that if you disagree with the system statement put out 2 years ago or a year and a half ago now, that you have to follow. You have to send a letter to them outlining that your disagreement and why. Then you have to have a meeting with them, and if that doesn't get anywhere, then you have to go to the administrative law judge. In that document that I provided is actually and should be the one of the things that highlights the inability of the law judge to look at this because of the reasonableness clause of 473.857. And that's the next bill that we're going to talk about.
Did you... Are you getting an answer then to your question, Representative?
Yeah. So the law judge did not allow or did not look at, they couldn't comment on or make a decision on this this issue because of that next 473-857. And that's what we're going to be discussing in the next bill, which basically says, in the way the Met Council hears it or sees it, the hearing shall not consider the need for reasonableness of the Metropolitan System plans or parts thereof.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Manager. My question was just pretty simple. Just if you could summarize the conclusion that was reached by the administrative law judge in this particular case.
They couldn't look at it. They wouldn't make a decision on it because they're not allowed to by statute.
Okay.
There was no decision in the law judge. Or in that.
All right. Well, I don't know. I'm going to go to Representative Kosnick, and then maybe we need to hear from Representative Mr. Shetland again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Carlson, my question was kind of along the similar lines. And I guess perhaps, you know, rather than kind of be the Planning Commission here, my concern is a little bit more with that, what's actually in statute that administrative law judges aren't allowed to challenge and look at the reasonableness of the plan, and perhaps we can get some input on why that is, and I think that's really maybe what the point is of perhaps a different bill should be to take a look at that, and I guess I'd be a little curious to give us some background on that, and I know we're running out of time, but I think that's really the important matter for in front of us. Thank you.
Okay, great. Representative Ibrahim.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little confused on the administrative law judge hearing. I don't know who to ask because I know it was late last night when I read it, but there was a 60-page report from the administrative law judge, very detailed, talking about how she ruled on the case. So I'm trying to find it on my phone because I'm a little confused.
Madam Chair.
Mayor Corrin.
Member, if I can get a copy of that and send that to you for clarity, would that be sufficient?
The Government Operations Committee. You're a member of that, I think.
Madam Chair, if maybe just the Met Council could come up maybe and briefly explain, because one side saying there was no ruling and one side saying there was a ruling, and I'm a little confused. Like I said, it was really late last night when I was trying to read it.
Brief comments, if we can, from Met Council.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Ms. Barras.
Thank you. The statute outlines that the hearing can be held in front of an administrative law judge or the council's land use advisory committee. In either case, either the ALJ or the land use advisory committee makes a recommendation to the Metropolitan Council for final action. So the council makes final decision on it, but the administrative law judge did issue a very long report that outlined the findings of fact in the case. His finding was that the Metropolitan Council recommended that the Metropolitan Council deny the city's request based on the need for the reasonableness of the Metropolitan System Plan. That was his primary finding. In the memorandum that he included along in his report, he also talked about the merits of the case that the city had presented. And that's at the end, and I encourage you to read that as well.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure who can answer this question, but what other communities are served by the East Bethel Wastewater Reclamation Facility, and what would be the cost to those communities if Oak Grove is allowed to back out of the agreement?
Ms. Barajas?
Madam Chair, Representative, the East Bethel facility serves East Bethel today and is planned to serve Oak Grove in the future. It's just those two communities. But how we charge ratepayers in the region is on a regional rate. We don't charge by we don't charge by plant. So this plant gets this rate or that plant gets that rate. It's absorbed as a regional cost and a regional ratepayer cost.
Madam Chair, may I add one
Mayor
thing?
Mayor Coran?
Madam Chair and committee member, currently the discussions around the East Bethel system serving Oak Grove, significant added costs just to get the East Bethel collector to the Oak Grove border would be necessary. East Bethel is not interested in continuing that pipe to their border We're not interested in paying for it into Oak Grove. So currently, they can't service phase one of their own collector system that's in place now.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify? All right. Seeing none, we're going to proceed with the vote, and do you want to renew your motion, Representative Barr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1117 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The bill passes. All right, now, we have your second bill, but we're going to do the Baker bill first, so... House File 1358, members. Okay. I believe we have a number of testifiers. We'd like to sort of restrict both sides, if there are both sides, to about 15 minutes apiece, so we give a fair hearing. So, Representative Baker, welcome. And I'm going to move your bill, House File 1358. And that is... going to move on to the Transportation Finance Bill. So welcome to committee, and please proceed and describe your bill for us.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and committee members. It's a pleasure to be here today. This is the 1358 House File Better Trucks Initiative. We're trying to be more efficient with our dollars and with our vendors that help us build our roads and bridges. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm just trying to make sure we are on a time constraint here, but we've been searching for better ways, faster ways to have our dollars go longer. So I think this is a really good idea about truly lowering the cost in a way that's really going to add up for us around Minnesota to build our roads and such. So you're going to hear some great testimony today. Madam Chair, again, we're trying to narrow this down a bit. You've heard this bill. This has been around for a number of years. We try to narrow this down a lot more for just kind of more construction materials and aggregates, and that's what we're trying to do today. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm just going to turn over to our testifiers and for them to carry the ball with this one. Thank you.
Very good. And will someone kind of walk us through the bill real quick then? So, all right, sir, you want to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Baker. My name is Brad Corrigan. I'm Executive Director of the Aggregate Readiness Association of Minnesota. Our association office is located in Eagan. House File 1358 reflects issues, as Representative Baker mentioned, raised last session and creates a new section in Chapter 169 of state statute related exclusively to authorizing special overweight permits for hauling construction materials. The bill does not include any provisions related to agriculture, such as backhauls of agricultural products, preserves the authority of local government to route or deny permitted trucks on local roads, and dedicates the revenues from permits issued under this section to the township bridge account. The bill includes the following provisions: construction materials means, highway construction materials, building construction materials, and associated demolition materials. It authorizes the MnDOT commissioner to issue annual permits for a vehicle or combination of vehicles with a total of six or more axles to haul construction materials and be operated with a gross vehicle weight of up to 90,000 pounds, and for an annual fee of $300, and to issue annual permits for a vehicle or combination of vehicles with a total of seven or more axles to haul construction materials and be operated with a gross vehicle weight of up to 97,000 pounds for an annual fee of $500. The bill does not change the current 53-foot length for semi-trailers in Minnesota. Let me reemphasize that. Does not change the length of vehicles in Minnesota, not by one inch. Vehicles or combinations of vehicles may be operated on paved or unpaved streets and highways other than interstate highways. And revenues from the permits, as I mentioned, issued by the commissioner must be deposited in the town bridge account and is available to inspect and post weight limit signs for town bridges. The history quickly of this bill: the 1960s, the federal government adopted state road weights for interstate highways, leaving Minnesota surrounded by states with higher weight limits, although all interstate highways are built to a 10-ton design. Minnesota state trunk highways are designed and operated at 10 tons per axle and already allow a 10% harvest increase and also allow a 10% winter season increase to 88,000 pounds gross vehicle weight today. In December 29th of 2005, MnDOT truck size and weight project findings for universal increase of trucks size and weights, again, universal all trucks, was their recommendations on our findings on Minnesota state and county highways to that heavier payloads and fewer trucks equal lower transport costs, additional axles and fewer truck trips equal less pavement wear, heavier vehicles equal some additional bridges posted and higher bridge design standards in the future, and heavier trucks equals slightly higher crash rates and fewer overall trucks equals better safety. 2008 legislation authorized special timber and agriculture overweight permits for six-axle 90,000-pound and seven-axle 97,000-pound configurations. Today, there are approximately 1,000 timber trucks, annual permits for timber, and 2,000 agricultural annual permits, generating over $1 million annually in permit fees that are dedicated to local bridge inspections and road posting signs. In 2015, Congress authorized trucks transporting forest products with a gross vehicle weight not exceeding 99,000 pounds with not less than six axles to operate on a segment of I-35 between Duluth and Cloquet. The federal government has recognized the timber permit. Taxpayer savings, quickly, the benefits of allowing slightly heavier trucks for trucks hauling construction materials are myriad, but most prominent among them are reductions in congestion, reductions in emissions, and overall savings to both businesses and taxpayers. Fewer trucks, the most significant thing, a more uniform standard for increased weights for trucks hauling construction materials in Minnesota would mean fewer trucks on the roads. Safety and road wear, repeated studies, including one that conducted by MnDOT in 2006 and another released by USDOT in 2015, show that the scary tales about road wear and transportation safety told by opponents of truck weight reform are simply not based in reality. Under this legislation, an increase in truck weight would be accompanied by a corresponding increase in the number of axles hauling those loads. More axles mean loads are more evenly distributed, and they mean more sets of self-adjusting brakes so that there is no increase in road wear and no decrease in safety. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Corrigan. And who is up next, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Baker and representatives. My name is John Bornhoft. I'm the current president of the Aggregate Readiness Association in Minnesota, and I'm the CEO of Buffalo Ridge Concrete. We operate in southwest Minnesota. I'm here to support House File 1358. One of my concerns is parity with our neighboring states. North Dakota has weight limits 105,500, South Dakota 129,000. Iowa 96, Wisconsin 90, and Minnesota 80,000. This is unfair competition. We run from 212 south to the Iowa border and over to Highway 71, 8,500 square miles. We compete in that market and unfairly. There's a severe driver shortage in the state. Lack of drivers. Our whole industry has equipment sitting for lack of drivers. By being able to haul additional payload, it alleviates some of that issue. Fred mentioned the MnDOT truck study on truck size and weight, better safety, fewer truck miles. MnDOT has also predicted the future demographics of our state is that they're predicting a gridlock in the next 20 to 25 years. So by increasing the weights, taking trucks off the road, you are going to help alleviate that gridlock. Less fuel consumed is also an issue, which helps on the governor's carbon reduction goals. There's been a lot of talk about safety. All of our trucks are driven by professional CDL drivers. We stress safety on a daily basis. We have safety meetings. Safety is a great concern for us. If we have a poor safety rating in our business, we are out of business. All of our trucks are inspected annually. As Fred mentioned, we have automatic slack adjusters on our trucks. Every one of these trucks that we're talking about, whether six-axle, seven-axle, will comply with the federal bridge law, which means that it's a federal standard for axle loadings. which is what all of our bridges in the state are built to. So that really should not be an issue. As far as the rail system, there's no statewide rail system. We are pretty much the construction products and ready-mix business are, we have to truck. There really is no full-blown transportation system that could service us. We do pick up a lot from terminals that are supplied by rail. This would have a direct financial impact. I'll give you one job that we did out of our Marshall plant. This is a 65,000-yard job, CapEx 2020. You might have heard about it, big power line. And if we had been able to hold 90,000 pounds, it would have required 3,000 fewer truckloads, and 97,000 would have been 5,300 fewer truckloads into our plant. So every time you see a loaded ready-mix truck, it has 0.8 tenths of a semi-load, 40,000 pounds of material in it. So just think, every truck that you see, wherever it's at, if it's full, it's 0.8 tenths of a semi-load that supplied that. That's what we're talking about, being able to supply our plants. Permitting fees will go directly to the township bridge accounts, and I know our company will purchase $250,000 to $300,000 worth of equipment the day after it's signed.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Bornoff. Yep. I believe we have a question or two. Okay. We're going to keep going, I think, so yeah. We hear
it's
from
a good,
everyone.
Good common
so.
Sense law.
All right. Thank you. Who's up next, please? Please give us your name for the record and proceed with your comments.
Good afternoon. My name is Tim Becken. I'm with Semstone Products Company. So we're in the ready-mix concrete, sand, and gravel business here in both in the Twin Cities and southern Minnesota. And I just wanted to speak in support of this bill. I can say that I was involved in with the MnDOT study when they did outreach in 2006 to really study this. And at the time, you know, MnDOT looked at really being for all trucks. And when that became political, it became, over the years, we've seen different ag products or different timber products being added. But clearly this bill is a way to bring equity within the construction materials business. In Minnesota, both in the Twin Cities particularly, we're really our aggregate resources are really quickly declining. So when you see the different gravel pits over the years that are closing or have closed just based on reduction of being essentially running out of materials, our materials are coming from farther and farther great distances. And so what that means is when you look at the cost of roads, majority of our products that are used are aggregates in those roads. And the majority of the cost of the aggregates actually is the trucking of those aggregates. The cost of aggregates, believe it or not, are relatively still small when you consider a project. The cost of the trucking can somewhere be 3 to 4 times what the cost of the aggregates are. And so you can literally have, it's really a trucking issue in terms of being able to bring sand and gravel to our different plants or to road construction projects. And I think this bill really does a good job of being able to be more efficient and be able to, as we go along, have more and more trucking of materials across our state. The last thing I would say is, in the wintertime, we are able to operate 88,000 pounds with a permit. So we are used to, with our existing equipment, 5-axle trucks, we're able to haul 88,000 pounds. What we're asking in this bill is to be able to go with 6 axles, an additional axle for carrying capacity and braking, to go to 90,000 pounds. So when you hear some of the arguments really against our bill because that it can't happen, believe it or not, it does happen. It just happens in the wintertime. People don't realize it. Unfortunately, being seasonal, that's a problem. Right. With that, I will conclude my remarks, but we really would appreciate your support in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And next up.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jason Dunnick with Dunnick Companies. I'm here today representing Dunnick Companies and also today representing the Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association. MAPA supports this legislation. Dunnick has a fleet of about 66 to 7 axle trucks, and we hired 20 to 25 more to satisfy our needs each day. Our safety record is one of the best in the industry, and we are very proud of that record. We train our drivers in advanced driving skills behind the wheel called CTOT. This class consists of approximately 1 hour classroom instructions and 5 hours of behind the wheel instructions, making the drivers aware of the vehicles and operating capacities and limitations. Dunnick does business in Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota. We find that South Dakota and North Dakota have already enacted an upper weight limit. Minnesota has not. In front of you today, in the map that I've given you, is a document that was bid in Kanawha County. This job was from Clear City, Minnesota to Wilmer, Minnesota on Truck Highway 23. The bid results were $1,935,147. I've assessed the savings as a result of increased load capacity from 80,000 to 97,000 pounds. The two quantities that I was working with were bituminous of 24,211 tons and millings of 23,023 tons. After calculating the numbers of increased savings would have been about $84,972 or about $1.19 a ton. $84,972 in savings translate to about 4.6% reduction in overall costs of that job alone. You also see that there is a reduction in the hauling trucks by 550 trucks. This takes trucks off the road and reduces our carbon footprint. Dunnick owns 7 ready-mix plants in Redwood Falls to Glenwood, Minnesota. We are finding that we are hauling aggregates from the pits are farther and farther away from all of our facilities. If weight limits increase, this would be a significant cost savings to the end user. With that, I conclude and thank you.
Thank you. And I show one more interested in speaking in support. Mr. Waffler? If not, okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Jim Waffler. I represent the Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association, and I wanted to echo what Tim Beckin said about having to haul aggregate and the importance of trucking in our industry. We represent 96% of all the producers, suppliers, and pavers in the asphalt industry in the state of Minnesota, and our members' companies represent thousands of good-paying Minnesota jobs. We support the provisions of this bill. I wanted to just make two particular points. We try in our mission statements to be good stewards. One is to be good stewards to the tax-paying public, and to keep costs down as low as possible. That's why we have bidding processes. This bill will result in fewer truckloads having to be hauled per job, and that efficiency translates into savings for the tax-paying public as well as for our businesses. In addition, we are also stewards of the environment. Our product is 100% recyclable, and we, by having significantly reduced truckloads, we will reduce our carbon footprint significantly, and that's part of our mission statement as well. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And we'll go to opposition testimony next. We have some folks coming up.
Oh, hi. Hi, guys.
Welcome, sir. Please give us your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Gies. I'm the Polk County Highway Engineer. I'm here representing the Minnesota County Engineers Association. One of the messages that we'd like to make out of this bill is it's clearly a call for how important our highway infrastructure is and how we have needs to invest in that so we can accommodate these very important loads and industries. To say we're opposed to the bill would be a slight exaggeration. We're not necessarily opposed to the premise of the bill. We have some concerns within the bill. A few years ago, we worked with ag interests to draft special legislation for permits for farm use. If you look at the details of this bill, specifically in lines 2.15 and 2.16, it refers to section 169.865, which is the special farm use permit, and it refers on 216 to several clauses, but eliminates two of them. Clause number four in the existing statute limits the special use for farms to paved streets and highways, which is of somewhat concern to us that it's omitted, but not our primary concern as county engineers. Our second and bigger concern is the omission of six, which stated must be issued from each road authority having jurisdiction over a road in which the vehicle is operated, if required. Earlier in the testimony, we heard Mr. Corrigan say that locals would have an opportunity to deny or work on certain roads that these could be put on, but we don't see it in this exact bill, and that's something we would like to work with the author and others to address. That's our main concern. Not all roads are created equal. It was talked about all trunk highway systems being the 10-ton standard. If you go back far enough, the state law was on county roads, the limit was 9 tons or 73,280 as a gross weight limit. That was switched to 80,000 on all roads outside of spring road restriction, and we've been working to get our system to 10-ton system, but it isn't across county and city and township roads. And so there are some roads that we would be concerned about these arbitrarily being sent down just by a permit through the commissioner. So we ask that you consider adding the ability to permit from local road authorities. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Solem, good afternoon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Solem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I'll first apologize to the author that we didn't get a chance to connect on this bill directly. I have met with Mr. Corrigan and Mr. Seifert, and I exchanged a number of messages. Unfortunately, we had our big conference the last couple of days, and it was hard to connect. Our association has long had a policy opposing any weight limit change. It doesn't matter the industry, but we are very grateful to this particular effort that they have reached out to us. They are trying to work with us. They're the first ones in the weight limits I've testified against. It's actually listened that, hey, we need revenue if we're going to put these kind of roads up. And they did recognize that by creating a fund to the town bridge account. And so that is a major step in the right direction, in our opinion. One area of concern that we have, and I'm not sure how we resolve it, but we keep talking, is that the extra axles are very beneficial for the pavement. They're not so good on gravel. Our folks are continually reporting that the extra axles dig in and actually worsen the condition of the gravel at the intersections. And I'm not sure. I'm not an engineer. I won't pretend to be an engineer. But those are the reports that we're getting. And so I said we're very grateful for the efforts that are going, and I'm pleased that we will keep talking and working as well. But those are some of the concerns that we have.
Very good. Thank you. And sir, you're next with some testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32. We represent an excess of 62,000 active and retired members in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 1358. Our union works tirelessly to create a safe work environment for our drivers. Many of the trucking drivers that deliver, whether it's for Semstone or other ready-mix companies, are the safest drivers, we believe, on the road. But it's also important that we create a safe environment for our roads that our general public travels on. I want to touch on a couple studies, recent studies. The U.S. DOT study recently resulted in some results that resulted in some numbers that should be concerning. With heavier trucks, 10% of these accidents that are caused by heavy trucks result in a 10% increase in fatalities. There's also an increase in brake maintenance for these same trucks. So just that alone, I mean, it's really concerning.
Another recent study with the American Road and Transportation Builders Association, which came out last week, determined that in the state of Minnesota, there are over 800 structurally deficient bridges that are operating right now with traffic going over them. In addition to that, there's 423 functionally obsolete bridges. So to put heavier trucks on these bridges is just could be catastrophic. Now, the proponents would like to say, would like to convince you that putting these trucks with more axles on a bridge would improve the ability for these trucks to go over this these bridges safely and wouldn't damage these bridges. But the argument to that is in a recent MAP 21 study that was released last year. The study concluded that bridges don't feel a difference whether it's an extra axle or extra three axles, whatever axles you want to put on it. The reality is a bridge feels the weight and takes the weight regardless of the amount of axles that are connected to a truck. I want to come to you with a different angle also that, you know, we always talk about local control. And for local communities to have the ability to control what happens in their areas, this bill provides zero local control to trucks that are going to be cutting through our cities, your districts, and right straight through downtown Main Street, Minnesota. And let me give you an example. And the proponents in an earlier testimony today had talked about an exemption that was provided for the timber industry in Duluth that would allow them to travel on our federal highway system for a very short period. I think it's under 2 miles. The reason that they were given this exemption was that there's an exemption in the timber industry that allows them to use a very small stretch of state highway to get the timber products to market. That state highway was right straight down Superior Avenue in Duluth. And within a year and a half, I believe it was, two trucks with timber on them had turned over. Now, if there was a car adjacent to that truck, it could have been catastrophic. Luckily, they moved it. But still, it's again, another exemption that it's just another slippery slope. I just want to touch on a couple more things, Madam Chair. What I heard today was the loss of jobs. When they come here and the proponents talk about, earlier he had said that he can do one job with 1,000 truckloads versus 1,426. That's lots of jobs. And one last thing, Madam Chair. The definition of what is in this legislation is very vague. And for us to expect our law enforcement, our state patrol, to determine what in fact is construction equipment is putting a very heavy burden on them. What happens when one of these troopers pull over a truck that's overweight and he or she has to determine whether something's construction equipment or not? It's just very vague, it's cumbersome, and it would be taxing on our already short-staffed state patrol. So with that, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity, and we hope that you will consider voting no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And next up, Mr. Mr. Abitz. Welcome. Give us your name for the record.
Please. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Abitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly & Kramer, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. With me today is Tim Jaske, who will introduce himself in just a minute. But just before we do, and I'm going to save a little time at the end, I just want to say for some of you folks, this is not a new debate. This is a refresher course. And for others of you who've been here before, but those who have not been here before, let me just say we really do appreciate you thinking through the technical, the safety, and the competitive issues that are involved in this. It's more than just dollars and cents and moving stuff around. There's several issues involved. Mr. Jaske is with the Twin Cities and Western Railroad. It's a short line railroad, and let me just very quickly say short line railroads are kind of like the mom and pop retail store on Main Street. They deal directly with consumers, and they deal with the manufacturers, the mining companies, the producers of agricultural products all across this state. They pick up and they deliver to the warehouses and to the businesses in small towns all over Minnesota. These are the ones who are most directly affected by increases in the size and weight of trucks that are being considered. At the conclusion of Mr. Jasky's remarks, I want to just fill in a couple other things that I think were missed, and I want to cover that, but I'll give
right.
Jim
the word. Mr. Jasky, please give us your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Jasky. I'm a general manager at Twin Cities and Western Railroad and Minnesota Prairie Line Railroad. We're located in Glencoe, Minnesota, and we serve the western, southwestern part of Minnesota. I will keep this brief for time restraints, but I do appreciate the time to come and discuss our business models and the impact that this may present us. As John stated, we are a mom-and-pop organization. Every carload that we move means a lot to us. We got a very small bottom line. In fact, right now with the agricultural community and the corn price that we're seeing right now, our margins are very minimal. We're running at a very minimal margin, and the reason we're doing this is to keep our people employed and waiting for the increase in commodities. So as a railroad industry, we develop our employees in-house from Minnesota. We take our employees, we train them, we develop them, and we retain them. We're very proud. We haven't laid a person off since the start of our railroad. So sometimes that's a huge financial commitment from us, but it's how we're committed to the communities around us and to our business. With that said, when we move rail cars, 50 rail cars moved on the dirt road equates to 175 trucks. They talk about taking trucks off the road. Rail industry takes trucks off the road. They take them off our infrastructure. Me as a taxpayer, I appreciate that. I don't like maintenance of roadways. I hate potholes. I hate driving on them. Our railroads interchange with our Class 1 partners in Minneapolis, the Burlington Northerns, the Canadian Pacifics, the Union Pacifics. And what that allows us to do is we allow the agricultural community of southwestern Minnesota to move their products to the world. We're not talking Minnesota. We're talking to the world. Allow their commodities to go to the Pacific Rim, and we're the conduit to allow that. So the reason we can allow that to do is our profitability. If we don't have it, we can't serve them. So I'd like you to consider the economic impact to the communities we serve and to the farming community, the agricultural community, when you consider this increase in truck loadings. Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Appitz?
Madam Chair, if I could just close real briefly. And Mr. Jasky works with one of the 18 short lines that operate here in Minnesota, and we are not everywhere. That's absolutely true. But we do serve a lot of small communities across the state. I woke up this morning trying to come up with an analogy that made some sense that would put this kind of in context, and I came up with the idea of your car and my car, right? You can probably go 100 miles an hour in your car. You may have gone 100 miles an hour in your car. That said, we don't let you go 100 miles an hour in your car, and that's for a very good reason. It's not safe. It's not safe to do that, and there's an analogy here, too. Heavier trucks are less safe. They have, they're more likely to roll over because you stack stuff higher, right? Physics, right? They have more braking issues, maintenance issues that's been reported several times over, and they cause more severe impacts when they're in an accident. I mean, think of it. You're talking about mass and velocity here. That's why law enforcement officials all across the state and across the nation, sheriffs, chiefs of police, have opposed the increase in larger trucks. If you drove your car 100 miles an hour every day, it wouldn't last very long. And the analogy applies here as well. Yes, we have 10-ton roads in Minnesota. Many of the roads are built to that standard. But just because somebody wants to push the limit of those roads to 10 tons doesn't mean that makes sense. In doing so, there's going to be more wear and tear on those roads as well. Let me just say, USDOT, in a study they did some time back, indicated that trucks weighing 80,000 pounds pay about 80% of the cost of the damage they do to the roads. Trucks weighing more than that, 97,000 pounds, for instance, pay about 40%, 40 to 50% of the cost of the damage. Who pays for the rest of the damage? you're going to pay for the rest of the damage, and so am I. That's how it gets paid for. In that same study, there was not the same study, but a study that came out at the end of last year, one that was supposed to be the conclusive study about what are we going to do about this issue of truck size and weights. The USDOT said, don't change it. Leave it the way it is. There's not enough information to really know what to do, so don't go changing it. As Tim said, they take a lot of trucks off the road. You don't want those trucks back on the road. Short lines will take the hit, and so will our roads and bridges. Thanks for hearing us.
I don't see anyone else that has indicated they want to testify, so we'll go to questions now. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for MnDOT. If they could come down, that would be helpful.
Welcome, Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, my question for Mr. Peterson is to, I'm really concerned about a number of things with this bill, the wear and tear on our roads, safety, those sorts of things. And I was wondering, what is MnDOT's position on this? And in including, do you have enough information to be able to be supportive of this? Or I would like to know where MnDOT's position is on this.
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Scott Peterson from MnDOT, Representative Bernardi. You've heard reference to the truck size and weight study that MnDOT did back in the mid-2000s, 2005, 2006. There were some recommendations relative to axle weight spacing, and some assessment of safety considerations. And with the information we had at the time, the bill that you see before you conforms with the recommendations of that study. But in the time since then, you know, there have been other studies done that have provided new information that still leaves some questions unanswered. So right now, our freight folks are telling me that this it seems a little premature to expand the amount, the number of weight limit exceptions that are already in statute and increase the number of these heavier trucks that are on the road.
So, Madam Chair,
follow-up representative?
Yeah, thank you. So MnDOT is opposed to this bill.
Well, we have some concerns about it, yes.
Mr. Peterson.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Bernardi.
All right. Representative Barr, Regina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of mine were along the lines of the safety questions, and I'm just wondering, and I'm not sure who to direct the question to, if we have any safety results from the surrounding states or in the instances where we already have exceptions, have we seen an increase in accidents or other things?
Mr. Peterson, I don't know if you have those answers.
Madam Chair, Representative Barr, I don't think that we have crash statistics that would isolate the impact of the existing permitted vehicles that run overweight on some of the other permits that we have. To my knowledge, the crash information we collect doesn't include that information.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when you say you have concerns, it's not necessarily that you're opposed, you just have some concerns because the data is not available.
Mr. Peterson?
Madam Chair, Representative Barrios, that's, I think, an accurate reflection of our
okay.
concern.
We'll go to Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think Mr. Appitz said it well. This is for the new folks, kind of an annual rite of spring, the truck weight discussion. And over the years, I remember for a long time, we said, well, we don't really want to take action because there's this federal study, and we're waiting for that final report. And I don't know who there's someone, one of the testifiers had passed out this summary of the USDOT report, which finally came out. It was very delayed. We thought it would come out in 2014. It's here in 2016. And, you know, it has some pretty important data. And we just heard about the older MnDOT study, but, 99% higher crash rates in Idaho, six-axle trucks up to 97,000 pounds, 400% higher in Michigan, 47% higher in Washington, and then some other interesting data along the way. So I know, I think this is, again, I'm not sure who passed this out, Madam Chair, but maybe whoever did might want to comment on this. This is significant.
Does anyone in the audience wish to claim the piece? Mr. Appitz?
Madam Chair, John Appitz, once again. Yes, this is material which I shared. This comes from the Coalition Against Bigger Trucks and goes directly to the question of safety with regard to the heavier trucks moving on the state of Minnesota. I'm not sure what needs to be said other than what's said here. Every state wasn't considered in this study. There were a number of states that were just only so much work they could do, apparently. But three that they did identify where they have heavier trucks, they did indicate that there were more and more severe crashes to take place.
All right,
Madam Chair, just to summarize, I mean, I think when we were talking about data and the need for that, I think this report was one we were waiting for, and it's out now, and I think it does indicate that we should be very, very cautious about this question. And then I would also add what I always add in this rite of spring, this rite of passage, that until we really get a comprehensive transportation bill where we can really address the wear and tear on the roads and fund it, since so much of our needs are around maintenance, I think it would be very premature to pass a bill like this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. All right, Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make it quick. I just want to say thank you, Representative Bake, for tackling this. I know it's been around for a long time. I've watched it from afar, never been immersed in the discussion. So I just want to quick ask a clarifying question so that I understand, because it's relatively new to me. Currently, these trucks, and even with your bill, would not be able to travel on an interstate. Is that accurate?
Mr. Baker.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Baker.
Okay, thank you. So they would mostly be traveling on local roads.
Madam Chair, that would be local Baker. State and local roads, correct, state highways.
And
Representative Joachim?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm so sorry. I think I heard one of the testifiers, one of the engineers, talking about removing subdivision sections 4 and 6 out of subdivision 3 and 169.865, and I grabbed them just to read them, and it does seem currently to get an permit or an exception, you'd have to get one from each local jurisdiction, but this takes that away.
Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, what this does is sort of similar to what they're doing, I think, with the ag stuff. MnDOT controls the permitting. I think the one component here that the county engineers brought up is, and I think something I still want to work on this bill, is to make sure that our counties and local folks get a lot of say, or at least communication lines. Because these trucks travel over the state of Minnesota, it's hard to do all these permitting around each county. So I think what we need to find is a new mechanism, and I'm willing to work with them, and I've told the engineers that I want to continue to do this and make this bill better. But this is a heavy lift, and it's been around a long time, but I want this bill because it's the right thing to do. And I want to make it better as it moves along, so I'm really working with the townships and the counties to make sure that they're on board with this communication style that we need to do to let these heavier trucks do more work for us for less.
And Representative We are going to be voting. Representative Joachim.
Thank you. Sorry, Madam Chair. So just so that I understand, too, it's having MnDOT do it, but I don't see an appropriation here, and we're not a finance committee, so I won't ask. But where is this bill moving next?
Transportation Finance.
Okay,
Representative.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cagle, and we're going to have to be really quick because we're going to take a vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Baker. So this may be a bit of an overshare, but I've always had an irrational fear of bridges. And so when looking at some of these figures and seeing that 11% of our Minnesota bridges are structurally deficient or functionally obsolete, what's going to be done to assure that an oversized load isn't going over a structurally deficient or functionally obsolete bridge while I'm on it?
Well, again, Madam Chair, and that's a great question. I think we have to make sure that our local folks can still post these bridges. If heavy trucks go over a bridge that's posted, they should get a big fine. And these permits that are being charged with bigger trucks are going to create new money and new revenue for bridge inspections, and I'm hoping that actually these funds eventually go back to our counties and townships to make sure they got funds for their bridge replacements would be my goal at some point. So this is going to create some new revenue, but we also have to find a way to get them more efficient so we can build more roads so that actually more trucks will be actually used so we can do more projects throughout the year, and more drivers will be needed just because we have more projects going simultaneously. That's my hope with this.
All right. Representative, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, please. And then, thank you, Madam Chair. What kind of burden would this also add to the state roads if they're not able to travel on the federal roads, the interstate?
What kind of a burden?
Yeah, would it add to our state roads?
I'm not sure I follow the question.
Just, you know, additional wear and tear, and it looks like there'd be a cost.
Representative, I wish you'd brought some of these things up, earlier, and that sounds a bit beyond exactly here what we're prepared to talk about. So,
and Representative Cable, I'll be happy to follow up on that offline if I could.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mason, very quickly, please.
Just once again bringing up the fact that we can't get a comprehensive transportation bill out, and so my thought is we probably should not deal with this till we do that. But even though, just from a personal standpoint, I don't know about you, but when I'm on freeways and I am surrounded by these huge trucks, it's darn scary, and there's quite a few times when that happens. So I just on for pure perception, I do not like bigger trucks at all.
Thank you, Representative. And seeing that we don't have any other questions or comments from the public or the members, I will proceed to a vote on the bill. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1358 be referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
No.
The bill passes and moves on to Transportation Finance. Thank you, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we aren't going to take up the bar bill at this point. We'll be talking with him about postponing it and talk with you online if we can. So thank you.
Good morning.
Meeting is adjourned.